Some of you have asked about past handouts, and Tyrone is picking through them up here at the moment. There's one of each of the last of all of them on the front seat over to the middle here. And after class, you can get some if you've missed one or two of them. And there's maybe 10 or 15 copies there, so not enough for everybody. But if you missed one or two, be sure and pick one up after class. Today is the last class. It's our review. And I always, at the end, when I'm setting up a schedule, have a review and discussion scheduled for the end in case we get a snowy day or something like that and can't. We didn't get one this winter. So we're actually going to have a review today. And that gave us a skip day in case we needed it. In honor of the rodeo show and rodeo and fat stock show, today is the last roundup, okay, for this class. All right. So that's what we're doing. The handout that you have has on one side specific conclusions that we're going to talk about in the presentation of the review, and on the other side we're going to talk about a general conclusion that sort of summarizes everything that we've got at this point. So we're talking about a specific book that was found buried in the sands of Egypt about 100 years ago, bought by a man named Charles Freer from the Egyptian treasure hunter and stored in the Smithsonian Institution. It was looked at originally by a doctor from the University of Michigan, named, let's see if I can remember his name. But anyway, he was not all that interested in the details, and so he gave it a cursory examination and wrote a couple of papers about it, but did not reach any specific conclusions other than it just seemed to be another copy of the Gospels, nothing special about it in his view. And so it was put in the Freer Gallery of the Smithsonian Institution and stored in a drawer there for about 80 years until the late 80s and 90s when Lee Woodard began to look at it. He went to see it, and I forget the specific reason why he was interested in it, but he thought it would be an interesting document to examine from the standpoint of forensics. And that's what we've been talking about in here. We haven't spent so much time upon the Greek involved in it. It's a Greek manuscript, including all four Gospels, missing three leaves or six pages out of those four Gospels, which were probably torn out by the treasure hunter and circulated among people who might possibly purchase it from him. Freer paid a little over $7,000 for it in 1906, which would be a considerable amount of money for that day, and probably if you had to purchase it today, if it had been discovered under similar circumstances, there would have been maybe $100,000 or more change hands to purchase it. It was offered to the British Museum, the Berlin Museum, several large museums, which turned it down, incidentally, and Freer finally got it, and Sanders, his name was the Dr. Sanders, took it apart and photographed the pages, and those very photographs from 1910 or so are the ones that are on the internet and that we've been looking at. Okay? So we if this is ever published or we ever write any more about it, this will have to contain an acknowledgement of the fact that the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts in, where is that? Remember where I said it was? Plano, Texas. That's kind of interesting. Plano has gathered manuscripts and pictures of manuscripts from all over, Many of them are not on the internet because the person who owns them didn't want it put on the internet, but you can go to Plano, apparently, and pull them out and look at them, and if you're doing research. Now, the research that Lee Woodard did was on the original manuscripts as they're stored at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. So, we acknowledge Henry Sanders and Lee Woodard and the CSNTM, and I'm going to run through a kind of a roundup of everywhere we've been over the past 2.5 months. I've got to do this in enough time, leaving enough time for us to answer questions and have some discussion here in a minute. So fasten your seat belts, and we'll go through this fairly fast. We begin with the pictures, which is a good place to begin. Some people are oriented toward the visual. And these are the oldest pictures of biblical subjects that are known. And as you will see as we go through this, this dates to the first century. Somebody drew pictures of the four men who are the authors of the four Gospels. And this is Matthew and John. And John has been mishandled, as you can see from his image. He's on the right-hand side of the book. It opens to the left. And apparently, the fingers rushing across his image have pretty well obliterated him. Matthew survived a little better shape. And in the back cover, those are wooden covers, incidentally. I showed those to you before. They're on wood. And they were placed one on the top and one on the bottom, and it was bound in to make a book, a codex. That's the meaning of the word codex. It's just a technical term. A book, the way we bind and look at books and their pages. Before that time, all of these kinds of writings would have been in the form of a scroll. Well, the one on the back survived a lot better than the one on the front, as you can see. Here's Luke and Mark. And we know that's who these are because in the case of Mark, and we've looked at him before, we noticed that his name was on that image. So, incidentally, concerning Mark, he's the only one who shows a hand. You notice how the others, their hands are up underneath their robes. They're holding the books that are represented, a representation of the Gospels here. But Mark's hand shows, and we made the point out of the fact that he is missing the end of a finger, like Bob Burright. And so that seemed to be significant to the artist. And so that supports the idea that Mark was a priest who self-maimed himself so he wouldn't be called in to serve as a priest in the Jewish system of things, because they were essentially conscripted to serve with their order of priests came up, then he would have to do it. But he didn't want to do it, so he's no longer perfect. And so, because he had been maimed, he could not serve as a priest. Anyway, we talked about these men and their backgrounds, and we'll get to that in a minute. Okay, we'll look at the four Gospels in order this time. And the order in the book is not the order that's in our Bible. It's Matthew, John, Luke, and Mark at the end. So here's Matthew, Matthew begins with this genealogy. And we looked at all those names. They're there just like in the same order that they are in your Bible. But there was something peculiar about this first page, that it is made of goatskin vellum, and the one on the right, which is the second page, the front of the second page, you can see that the edges decayed in a different way. The left edge is always straight because it's the binding edge, and it was cut apart. It was where the paper was folded, where the vellum was folded. And so the first page containing the genealogy had been attached to the first choir, which is a group of 16 pages that make up the rest of this, 16 and then 16 and 16. as you go through the way in which the book was bound. So the first page was brought to the site where the rest of the copying was done, and it contains the genealogy, which appears to have been written by the same scribe as the one who wrote the rest of it, the rest of Matthew. But on the other hand, it is a separate page that was added at the time. And since all of the other copies of the Gospel of Matthew contain the genealogy, this must have been the point at which it was added into the story which Matthew had written. So this is the first of a series of specific conclusions that you have on the back. The genealogy of Jesus was a late addition to Matthew's Gospel, and it was included in the Sinai, Alexandrian, and Vatican copies, indicating that they were copied from Codex W. Now we're going to look at those conclusions and gather them together at the end. So that Matthew put his seal at the end of the of his Gospel, and you see it here. And on this, it's right here. And so the seal we take to be a mark of authorization and certification that the gospel was exactly what the author intended it to be, and that implies that he was present when this was copied. And there it is. Enlarged. Now, part of Matthew's name extends out from underneath the seal. What you have here is an M-A, a theta, theta, but the A-I-O-S, a capital C, I'll remind you, is an S, a sigma, in these capital letters in the Greek transcriptions. And they're very tiny writing, and in addition, as Woodard noted, there's little notations also in Aramaic, and I can't tell you what that means, but the fact that there is Aramaic writing is significant because these are the only copies of the Gospels that contain such things. So it is implied that Matthew approved this writing by applying his seal. And in addition, there was a date symbol added at the end of each of the Gospels, and that implies an early date. And here was the explanation that we had to calculate the date. They were using the Roman calculation of dates, which began at the founding of Rome in AD 754 BC. And so The date symbol will include some ideas that suggest that we add some to that date to find out the date in which the symbol was written. And to find the date in AD, you subtract 754 from the date of what's called the AUC date. If the date were AD 827, in the example here, that would be 73 A.D. You would subtract 754 from 827, and that would give you the A.D. date. All right. So here's the symbol. And the date symbol for Matthew's gospel includes this bird drawn over here, a picture of a bird, and a set of lines above and below it. And if you add up the lines, there's seven above it. He's resting on the eighth line, and there's eight dots and lines below it. And then there's a tail, which tells you in the 800th year, you add so many more years to it to get to the date in which the document was finished. And here we have chevrons and dots, and you add those across as Lee Woodard suggested, and there's 21 pieces to his tail here, which would be 67 A.D. Now that's at the point in which Rome was invading Israel. But this is happening in Egypt, remember. This is at On Egypt in a place near Cairo, and the Christians had left Israel by and large before the Roman invasion, and apparently, as we'll see later on, they had met in Egypt to do this transcription. Okay. So the date symbol of Matthew indicates its completion in 67 A.D. And we'll see that there's a symbol like that at the end of each of the Gospels, and it must mean something. They took the trouble of drawing a symbol of that sort in each case. All right. The first page of John's Gospel consists of a choir of 16 pages. That's what we're talking about up here. 16 pages, the first choir. And they're the work of a different scribe from the rest of the codex. That earlier copy had been written by somebody else of John's Gospel, and it was used as a source for distributing the Gospel, because most of the Gospel of John, copies of the Gospel of John, which are found, don't include the mistake that this scribe made, and we talked about the scribe's mistake. And so he began his work on page 17, because the first 16 pages by this previous scribe are included and just stuck right in with the rest of the codex here. And we looked at that in detail. It has to do with the discussion about the man healed by Jesus. It was the Sabbath on that day. The Jews said to the one having been healed, "It's a Sabbath, and it's not lawful for you to carry your mattress." Remember that? And he answered them, "The one making me whole, that one told me, take the..." And this is at the top. This is the first thing up here that the new scribe wrote. "Take the mattress of yours and walk." But the one cured did not know who it was, for Jesus withdrew, a crowd being in the place. And he's looking at the end of the words here, "Take your mattress and walk." And that is repeated four times in this story. And he picked the wrong time, the wrong occasion to go on. And in doing so, he omitted verse 12. Verse 11 ended, "The man who made me well said, pick up your mat and walk." And he thought that's at the end of this one. And so he went on with verse 13 up here. And it says that the one who was cured didn't know who it was. Well, that little mistake of skipping across tells us that the mistake was originally made when they put together the first 16 goatskin vellums with the rest of the manuscript, and the scribe started out. This is the scribe who wrote all of the rest of the codex. So the manuscripts omitting John 5:12, and there's nine of them that are known, and that means there must have been a whole bunch of them that were copied from Codex W that included that mistake. So that is we know why the mistake occurred. We know where it occurred. It occurred in Codex W, and then when it occurred in the rest of these manuscripts, it means they were copied from this one. So this is an early manuscript. That's another piece of information that says it's early. The accidental omission of John 5:12 that was replicated in other copies of the Gospel confirms its use as what we'll call a primary document. Okay? So that's significant. And then the seal of John is also interesting because he didn't place it down here where the rest of the seals were. He placed it up here. And they wonder, well, why? If you go, and there it is, right there. If you go to look at where he put it, it's in his discussion at the end of the Gospel of John. This is the disciple who testifies to these things. It's John the Apostle. And who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true, and he put his seal on the word for true. Jesus did many other things. If everyone were written down, I suppose even the whole world couldn't contain all the books, he went on to add. And so we know the purpose of the seal was to show that the testimony was true and that the person who had written it was authorizing it and giving, certifying it as his work that the scribe had completed. The placement of John's seal on the word true is the certification of his gospel, and it confirms the use of the seal as a symbol of authenticity. And it doesn't occur on any other manuscripts. Those seals are not present in Vatican or Sinaiticus or the Alexandrian manuscripts, just Codex Danium. They're less than a half inch. They're small. But they contain underneath them some writing, and so it's pretty clear. And actually, in the originals, if you look at them, you can tell there was something there that is evaporated by and large that covered the writing that is there. And what's in the writing under the seals is usually a name, either in Greek or in Aramaic, plus the place in which the document was transcribed, and that's A-U-N. And that's visible under some of them as well. All right, here's John's bird, dating bird right here. And his tail is a little different. And this was a tail that Lee Woodard said you count the feathers on the tail to figure out when it was. And he counted all of these up and got 50 feathers. And so he dated it as A.D. 96. But I think that's a little too late for John to be present, even though John was an older man, and really a very old man. He lived a long time in New Testament times. But the others, what we're counting are the waves in the tail, in the ups and downs in the tail. And if we do that, we'll get 25 of those, and that would date it to A.D. 71, which I think is a more reasonable date, and we'll see why when we conclude all of this in a minute, or a few minutes. Okay, and here's John's name at the bottom of it here. So, the first and last pages of Luke's Gospel, we've talked about it, and you can see his seal is placed right there. And there's this bird and a tail, which tells us when it was done. And we talked about the fact that Luke's gospel is made by a Gentile. It's written in excellent Greek, and it would be very impressive to the Greek world or to the Gentile world to have his gospel and his certification that everything written about Jesus was true. So here, his tail now is a double helix. I like that because I'm a biologist, but anyway. Oh, wait, let's go back. Get the right button here. You can see it has little dots in it. Also, tick marks above it suggesting that people were counting along this tail to see how many turns there were to it. And it turns out there's 27. That would date it to A.D. 73. And Mark, of course, as we get to the last one, Mark had trouble ending his gospel, as we talked about that before. And not only in many of the copies it ended at verse 8, but here apparently he had thought about ending it here about verse 18. But then, and he put a seal there, we talked about this back in January. And then he thought, no, I don't want to end it there. I'm going to add this much more and put another double stop, which shows you the end of the book. And then he put a seal over here. And finally the scribe put in the dating symbol here. And this is, here's Mark's name down here. So this is the last of the books, of the Gospels in the book. But there's also some scribbling up here at the top, and there's some more script down here. And those are kind of interesting, too, because they give us a real clue about how old all of this is. If we look at at what he was doing when he first wrote an ending that said, all these signs will accompany those who believe, and that's where he stopped the first time, put his seal. And then he decided, no, I need a better ending than that. The Lord Jesus had spoken to them. He was taken up into heaven. The disciples went out and preached everywhere. The Lord worked with them and confirmed his word. And then he put another seal down here, another double stop. It doesn't have brackets around it, of course. That's just to point it out. And so it indicates he was working on it at the time it was transcribed. And it has to be during his lifetime. So it's got to be first century. It can't be something from the 3rd or 4th or 5th century like Henry Sanders suggested. And so, the placement and subsequent erasure of a seal at the end of Mark's Gospel, followed by the addition of a more appropriate ending and placement of another seal, indicates that the document was still being completed when Codex W was assembled in AD 72. Now, at the top of that last page, you remember there was another thing about the ending, and some of these copies ended at verse 8, and the back side of the last page was not occupied at the time that this was written up at the upper edge. It's a kind of a pleading prayer that we talked about. Cleanse your temple. And presumably somebody's name goes in here or back over here, but the writing is obscured. But you can see, you can make out these large block letters in Greek, and cleansing the temple, the N-A-O-N is the word for temple, that can only mean the Jerusalem temple. Lord, cleanse your temple. And this from the priest, Mark, who had been intimately associated with the temple and was undoubtedly aware of what was going on when Rome invaded Jerusalem and Israel and was surrounding Jerusalem, and the zealots were piling bodies in the temple courts. They didn't have a place to bury anywhere, and they were cooped up in Jerusalem by the army, and so the temple was desecrated. And here's Mark apparently pleading with a note that he put at the top up here, and it's in the wear edge that's decaying away, and so that wasn't added recently. That was added when the page was new. And it's a crude representation of the Greek letters. And so it was written by someone who wasn't familiar with Greek, but was told what letters to write. So the prayerful appeal for cleansing of the Jerusalem temple in the crude script at the top of the last page of Mark's Gospel is indicative of an AD 60s date for this incomplete document. That's before he came back and added the last 18 verses, or let's see, bringing it from verse, the last 12 verses, bringing it from verse 8 to the end of Mark as we have it now. So, then we have this business at the bottom of that page, down here, that includes some little crosses here and one over here. As you can see in the enlargement. And this was a blessing conferred on somebody by the scribe, and apparently it was Barnabas. And we talked about that last time. And I think it was Mark. That symbol of a cross that is there is a peculiar one with a large row, R. This is an R in the Greek letters. And a big B over here. And it's thought that originally he had written his name out in the crossbar of a large row here to make his cross. And that was some sort of a symbol that he had developed to represent his signature. And so the seventh item here is the cruciform seal of Barnabas at the end of Codex W identifies him as the scribe who wrote the Greek versions of the four Gospels. And it is the same scribe all the way through, except for those 16 pages of John. So, a general conclusion. and that's on the other side. If you put all that, think about that, which I've been doing for more than 2 months. I started thinking about this last summer, actually. If you put all of those little bits and pieces together, think of it as a jigsaw puzzle, and you have these pieces that indicate some dates and some that were finished, some that were not, some that were added at the time, and so on. You get this sort of an overall picture when you begin to put the puzzle together. We don't have all the pieces, obviously, but we have enough to see how they fit together and how part of the picture looks, and that's what I've got here. From the and this is forensics evidence. Now, this isn't evidence from reading the Greek or anything like that, except to find big sections that are present or not present sort of thing. So here we have the general conclusion. In 65 or 66 A.D., Matthew and Mark met Barnabas in On Egypt, where the scriptorium is, to assemble a codex of their two gospels. Matthew's work was completed in 67 A.D., but Mark had problems with the ending of his gospel and left it unfinished, intending to return and complete it at a later time. However, Mark's incomplete document was distributed before he returned. They maybe thought he wasn't going to return, and it found its way into the Sinai and Vatican manuscripts. So his unfinished document, ending at verse 8 in the 16th chapter, is what you have on those two major manuscripts. In about 70 A.D., Mark brought John and Luke to On so that Barnabas could translate and copy John's gospel. Luke's gospel was already in Greek and needed only copying for a codex, for the codex they were preparing. So he had to translate and copy John's gospel, but he only had to copy Luke's gospel. John's writing was finished in 71 A.D., and Mark completed his in 72 A.D., and Luke's treatise was completed in 73. You see, they came, this puts several of them there at the same time. And Mark's completed version was incorporated into the Alexandrian manuscript. So that's the case that Mark's gospel in the one major Egyptian manuscript, the Alexandrian, includes all of Mark as we see it. The completed gospel codex was the primary source document for distributing the story of Jesus to the entire Gentile world in the first century. And you see why they were doing this. They could, Paul and others could go places and preach it orally, but they needed it written down. And that's what they were after here. Greek was the universal language of that time, but copies in Latin, Coptic, Syriac, and other languages eventually appeared. So you see the importance of what they were doing. They had to distribute this in some written form so that people would have something to refer to. And that's what they were assembling. And I think it all came into being within a 10-year span here from about 65 to 73 A.D. The importance of it is that the Gospels are supposed to represent eyewitness accounts, aren't they? And Matthew and John obviously were eyewitnesses of what they wrote. Mark probably saw it as an outsider and heard a lot of Jesus' public preaching, but not as one of the apostles. And then Luke, who did his research later while Paul was in prison, he was a companion of Paul. But as Luke investigated the situation and interviewed many people, including Mary, and all of these people who were eyewitnesses had been miraculously endowed by the Holy Spirit with the ability to recall everything that had happened. That's really critical. Jesus said that would be the case, that they would be able to remember everything that he had said to them. Now you think about somebody you met 10 years ago and you had a conversation with them. Can you recall the conversation? If it was really important, you might could, if you have a really good memory. Who is that lady on TV that's an investigator who can't forget? that's possible, I suppose. And apparently there are people who have such memories that when they see or hear something, they can't forget it. They have total recall. Well, that's what these eyewitnesses were given. And Luke was able to interview them and write all of that down and compose his gospel. The others were either eyewitnesses themselves or had access to the eyewitnesses. So that's the critical aspect of it. The miraculous part is the being able to remember everything that they had seen. And then God gave them, in addition, through his Holy Spirit's inspiration, the ability to make it clear. Those are the two things that are obviously required in producing these gospels. And so we have here how it was all put together. And those conclusions that I have put together, and I've given you those as the handout. Now we've got 10 or 15 minutes that we can talk about this. If some of you have questions or comments that you want to make, and I see a stirring over here. John wants to say something. Well, and their excuse is that the Bible is all hearsay that was written down hundreds of years after it happened. This proves that's not the case.
And what I was wanting to know is it possible to prepare a lesson on any evidence they have, if they have, that it was? Because can they counter us?
I don't think so. I don't think there is any evidence other than just the absence in their mind of any direct evidence. Jesus didn't write anything down. But, well, he wrote it in the sand on one occasion, and it blew away. So it had to be recorded somehow, and they say, well, it wasn't recorded. It's all hearsay, and it was all mythology assembled hundreds of years later. That's clearly now not the case. And their evidence, there isn't any. I mean, their evidence is the lack of evidence in their mind. Sure. Well, and there could, obviously, our answer has always been, well, there were writings, but they've been lost. Well, they were lost, but now they're found. And that's always the case. There's clearly manuscripts that didn't survive. Okay. But the skeptic is going to say, well, show me. And if they didn't survive, then they didn't exist in his mind, but now they do. And I think once this is known, it can be a very powerful tool when you're talking to somebody. What we've got to do is put it in writing. And that's what I'm thinking about right now, is going through this with you and getting your feedback and your response to these things and seeing how it could be put into a book or an article in a magazine or something. Okay. Sure.
And has been since the beginning of the Christian era and before to do anything he could. And of course, he can't do anything without God allowing it. God had a reason for leaving these obscure for so long. Our belief in God is faith-based. And while these things are wonderful for me, just like the evidences from the flood and those things, they don't change the basis on which I believe in God and I believe in His Son, Jesus Christ. But it's very affirming. And maybe God has let these come to, there's no knowing for sure, but maybe God has let these come to light in our time because of the way Satan is using so many tools now, and he knew it was going to happen, to discredit the Bible.
Yeah. Well, and the world's full of skeptics. And also, you're right, we don't need this for us, but we need it when we're teaching somebody else. And I think that's the critical aspect of it. And there are people, I'm sure there are people in the church whose faith is somewhat weak. And if they can be reassured that what they have in their scriptures is indeed what happened. Now you have to keep in mind there's a step between the original manuscripts and your reading of it in English, and that's translation. And Satan has perhaps a possibility of sticking something in there occasionally to make things obscure. But by and large, we have access to the Greek, which was the first translation from the Aramaic, and in Luke's case, it's the original material.
Is there any book out there that puts all this together that you've been thinking
about? Lee Woodard made this book. It's called, and you'll find it on the internet. He has a newer version of it. This was 2004, I think. Codex W, he spells it with a K. Old and Holy is the name of this book by Lee Woodard. He's written another book in conjunction with someone else in 2008, which is an update of this, a rewrite of it. But the problem with his book, it contains all this material, but the problem with his book is he's kind, you can think of him as a scientist, a forensics expert, but he's not a good writer. And so although he tries to divide it up into headings and things, he repeats himself over and over, and it's just difficult reading. And I think a lot of people dismiss it simply because it isn't very good writing. So, yeah, there is something. Well, the second one was a little bit more improved, yeah. But nobody picked it up, put it in Biblical Archaeology Review would be an ideal place to put something like this. And so I'm thinking of how could this be abbreviated and the points made without making it that thick and publish a brief synopsis of it all. Just to point out to the world that it's there with the key points. Point back here. About 1900, apparently, an Egyptian treasure hunter dug them up out of the sand near an old church ruins, about 30 miles south of Cairo, Egypt. That's not where On is. That's not where the scriptorium was, but that's where they were buried in the sand. They were wrapped carefully to preserve them and buried in the sand. He dug them up and unwrapped them and realized what he had and began to look for a buyer. But he was interested. He knew it was critical. It was interesting. It was old and holy in his view. And somebody would buy it if he advertised it well enough. It was about 6 years later before he finally got a buyer in Charles Freer. I think it's interesting it was sent to America. It could have been lost in the British Museum or the Berlin Museum or even in the Russian. The Russians were collecting manuscripts too at the first part before World War I, first part of the century. So it could have gone anywhere, but they didn't. They decided not to buy it, and Freer bought it for the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian is America's attic. You've heard that description of it. And so it's easy to lose stuff in the Smithsonian, and I can understand why it got misplaced and nobody paid attention to it for a long time. But when God's ready, he brings stuff up. He'll send somebody to dig it out and do something with it. I don't know if that's me or not, but I am interested, and I've contacted Woodard several times. We've talked about it. And if you contradict anything Woodard said, he dismisses you. He's one of those guys. If Woodard is the final authority in these matters, and if you differ with him, well, see, I differ with him on the interpretation of one of the birds. So, anyway, you can make a joke out of that. I won't. So, that's for the birds. Yeah. So anyway, there'll have to be some convincing and some negotiation. Gail? It's only by divine help that these things survive. And I think most of the manuscripts come out of Egypt because of the dryness and the preservation of things in the sand. Well, I want to thank you for your close attention and good attendance and all of this and the comments that you've made. Thank you very much. Now, today I have laid out on the front page, on the front seats up here, all of the back issues of the handouts. If you missed a handout, you want one, there's some up here. Help yourself. Thank you.